Let's begin our sharing tonight with the motivation. I've been thinking about this beginningless existence that we've had here in samsara, going from upper rebirths to lower rebirths over and over and over again, propelled by afflictions and karma, the fundamental misunderstanding how things actually exist that propels all of that. And I was thinking that since beginningless time, we must have been totally habituated in believing the four distortions, which really are some of the main causes for why we still cycle through samsara over and over again, experiencing birth, aging, sickness, and death, in whatever realm we are propelled into. And so having this very fleeting, precious opportunity called precious human life, which when you think about how old our universe is, how old the galaxy, the planets, the stars, the mountains are, 90 years, 100 years of human life is, as Shanti Davis said, like a flash of lightning in a dark sky. But believe it or not, here we are with this wondrous, precious human life. And we have the great fortune of having all the freedoms and fortunes that come with that life, including access to the teachings and including access to this most provocative commentary by Aryadeva, the 400 stanzas, of which the first four chapters just really bring right up to our faces the four distortions and how they are so much the cause of our misery, so much the cause of our confusion, our grasping, our clinging at our bodies, our lives, our existence, over and over again. And that we have the opportunity in this life to have access to such remarkable teachings such as these. And so since this life is so darn short, and for many of us more than half over, let's really connect with our intention tonight to listen to the Dharma, to try to appreciate and to receive and take in these teachings that are some of the most powerful antidotes to the four distortions. Aryadeva's direct and powerful teachings on how to help us to transform our minds, to see those four distortions for what they are, to really come to understand how things exist perhaps a little bit more clearly, so that we can remove all the obstacles to our practice, all the obstacles that get in the way to our awakening. And to realize that there isn't any living being in all the universes that doesn't struggle and is not under the control of these four distortions as well. So little by little, as we get some clarity about them, let's make strong aspirations and prayers that we have in some life in the future realization of the truth of the nature of reality, so that we can become Buddhas quickly in order to lead all beings out of this confusion and these misapprehensions of how things exist. Let's just really connect with our curiosity and our sincere wish to understand the Dharma tonight, for the benefit of all. And so while Venerable's been away in Asia teaching and receiving teachings, she asked the Sangha community here to review the seven chapters that she's taught on in Aryadeva's 400 stanzas. And in the first four chapters, we've got the four distortions. It's been quite a journey so far. So I'll go over a short review of the first two chapters, and tonight we're on the third chapter, dealing with the third distortion, and Aryadeva's very provocative, in-your-face refutations of how the body and sexual pleasure and sexual intercourse and sex in general are totally overrated and are the cause of huge amounts of suffering and actually contributes to our still being in samsara. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And one of the things that I think I had to get used to with this, with these verses, is that Aryadeva has a very, he's just really in our faces about this. You know, and there's part of me that likes to receive the Dharma in kind of a gentle, easy stroking, take my time, maybe I'll think about it, maybe I won't. And Aryadeva, you know, he's so persistent and so insistent that we understand how much suffering and how much trouble and how we are in samsara because we believe these four distortions. So in the first one, he challenged our view of permanence because we tend to look at things as being static, as being unchanging, that the circumstances that we have now will always be, that the people that we know now will always be there, that the kitties that we love will always exist, and that, but when we think about it this way, you know, so the first chapter was, and using death as the most profound, gross example of impermanence, is that looking at the way that we see things as permanent, that he's challenging us to revisit that so that we can start seeing how much that causes a lot of our afflictive states of mind, and that when we, when our view of looking at things and seeing them as stable, secure, and reliable, when we re-examine them using his stanzas, that we really start to see how false and how untrue that is. So we went with that on the first chapter. And then the second chapter, he challenged our view of what happiness is, because we usually think that happiness is totally because of the sense objects outside ourselves, that things that we taste and touch and hear and see and smell are really the cause of our happiness. So Venerable Sompton gave us a great sharing of that last week on how that simply isn't true, that our reputation, our status, success, lots of friends, anything outside ourselves, we believe to be the cause of our happiness when in fact it is the cause of a continual unsatisfactory condition. And that what we call happiness is actually, which I have found the second suffering, the suffering of change, to be one of the most profound teachings, is that what we call happiness is a low-grade suffering that's removing another kind of discomfort, another larger suffering at that time. So happiness doesn't even exist the way in which we think it does. And that by looking at the nature of dukkha as unsatisfactory, we start seeing and that we start, it helps us give up the mind that chases after sense objects, thinking that they are the cause of our happiness. So in the second chapter, Aryadeva really challenged us to look at where we see happiness, where we see how it exists, and where we think that it comes from. And so that's the second of the two distortions, is the distortion of seeing things that are by their very nature unsatisfactory as happiness. And then the third one, which we're going to talk about tonight, is the misconception that those things which by their very nature are foul and impure as clean and pure. And we're going to use, and they use our bodies and other people's bodies as the main example of this. And what Aryadeva does is that he goes through these 25 verses and he talks about what's inside our bodies, what comes out of our bodies, what is inside other people's bodies, what comes outside of other people's bodies. He totally strips away all the romantic notions about our bodies in this verse. And so we get to explore some of the questions about why am I so attached to this body? Why do I cling to it so strongly? And what's going on when I'm attracted to other people's bodies? I mean, what does that have to do with anything? I mean, what is that about, really?
And so tonight we're going to explore that. We're going to talk about sex. We're going to talk about sexual intercourse. We're going to talk about sexual attraction. We're going to talk about desire. And I know it must be funny having a nun telling you that we're going to talk about sex tonight, but Arya Deva is going to talk about it, and I'm going to just kind of try to channel him in some way. So there are some things that Venerable did for this chapter, because she really did want to make it gender neutral. Because when Arya Deva taught this chapter, he was basically talking to straight men. So all of the verses have things about women's bodies and how foul they are and how unattractive and all the craving that comes from looking at them and how that's all just crazy thinking. So she changed all the women ones to something like the person you're attracted to. Although some of the verses do specifically talk about ancient India, when the culture of women, what the way that women were sort of held in ancient India was kind of specific to the gender. So tonight, we're going to use Joe and Johanna Blow. Because this chapter is all about body parts. It's all about sexual pleasure. It's all about how we impute on each other the bodies, the parts, how they look, how they walk, how we touch them, and how we relate to them. It is so about sexual fantasies and about imputing what those parts mean and how our craving mind sort of gets triggered by looking at certain parts of the body. So instead of just making it vague, we're going to have Joe and Johanna Blow. And these are the voices that are going to try to tell Arya Deva, no matter how much he tries to tell us that the body is foul and unclean, they're going to have all the buts, but, in these 25 verses. And to watch Arya Deva and Venerable, who had some of the most incredible commentary on these verses as well. So they're going to be interfaced together with a little bit of Geshe Topke and also Gyalsubji. Okay, so we're starting with verse 51. So the first thing Joe and Johanna say, okay, although the body's nature is unsatisfactory, the body still gains pleasure and satisfaction through the experience of attractive objects. Thus, the attractive object is reasonable. So the first thing that Venerable says about this is, she said, some who says that says even though they understand that the body's nature is unsatisfactory, it's still okay to have pleasure from them. She says that they don't know what they're talking about, that they really don't understand what they're saying. And so this follows quickly the verse that says, regardless of the amount of time concerning objects, there is no limit. Your exertion for the body's sake is useless like a bad physician's. So Joe and Johanna are saying not only is it, you know, okay, even though they are in the nature of unsatisfactoriness, that it's okay to have pleasure, it's okay to be attracted to them because this is the experience. And on verse 51, we're talking about, I think it's a universal sort of cultural expectation, is that you really engage in the exploration of sexual desire when you're young. And so Joe and Johanna say, well, I'm sure that if I have all this pleasure when I'm young, I'll be satisfied, and so when I get older, I'll calm down and I'll do all of my spiritual practice that I've kind of put off since because I was young. So Arya Deva says, you enjoy sense pleasures when you're young, and then you practice religious endeavors when you're older, after you've accomplished all that you wanted to do. And so Arya Deva says, I say that you're not going to be able to do that. In fact, I'm almost guaranteeing that that's not going to happen. You know, you say when you're young you're going to get it all out of your system, and then when you're older and mellower you're going to become a serious practitioner. He says that there is no limit to the number of things that your mind will crave and the amount of time your mind spends craving them. So if you spend all of your youth craving and enjoying sexual pleasure and desire, by the time you're old, you have not attenuated that desire and that craving in the mind whatsoever. So just because you live it up when you're young, totally immersed in the eight worldly concerns, totally into finding pleasure in your life, there is no guarantee that you're going to be satiated by the time you get to be old and decrepit. The body might not be able to do much, but the mind is still going to struggle with desire and craving. And that because you've created such a habit of craving and enjoying stuff, implanting that confused notion of that pleasure in your mind will just be doing the same foolish things even when you're old. Which, I don't know, it's kind of sad to see very, very old people trying to do what they used to do when they were young as far as sexual desire and sexual pleasure. It's kind of, I don't know, it's just kind of sad. I'm sorry. And so, like a bad physician that is incapable of giving a treatment that works, his or her efforts are fruitless. So our efforts to satisfy the body are as fruitless as well. So this whole first notion of, you know, if we just get it out of our system when we're young, we're going to be okay when we get older, is one of those false notions that Arya Deva says, forget it. Okay, verse number 52. Just as a craving for earth does not stop those who subsist on it, similarly, longing for sensual pleasure grows in people as they indulge. Okay, so we're kind of still in the same vein. This is here's Joe and Joanna's butt. Just as thirst is gone as you drink enough water, those who are satisfied by sense pleasure won't crave anything anymore. And at this point, I love Venerable's commentaries on this verse. She jumps right in and says, I hear this all the time when people come to India. They come to the Dharma courses in India, and they really believe that they can have everything in moderation, that they can be satisfied, you can be content, that you can have all this pleasure and it's fine. She says, what are they talking about? The nature of samsara is dukkha, relentless unsatisfactoriness, and these people have convinced themselves that they can moderate their craving, that a little bit of pleasure is okay, a little bit of dharma is okay, I'm doing just fine. And she says, what are these people talking about? They don't get it. They're totally out to lunch. You're kidding yourself. And Arya Deva says, as earthworms never stop craving the earth, which it subsists on, and if you ever want to check a compost bin, you look at those little worms that you put in your bin, they never stop eating. They eat and they poop, and they eat and they poop. And if they're doing a really good job, at the end of a fairly short time, you've got all this really lovely worm poop for your garden. But they never stop. And so that is for the experience of the craving increases because we're indulging. We're sort of like those little worms, is that we just continue to ingest. We continually try to seek satisfaction. We continually just engage in the sensual sort of potpourri that we have in our world. And it never ends. It's like we can't get satisfied because it's not out there. The happiness, the satisfaction isn't out there, but we're like these little worms. So Venerable says, if this longing for sense pleasure didn't increase, because they're saying after a while, if you get enough of it, you should be able to come to some sort of satisfaction, then why do we go through the trouble inventing all those sex toys? Why do we want bigger houses, more expensive computers, more shoes, more gadgets, if sense pleasure can be satisfied? We have no satisfaction but have this crazy thinking that acquiring new and improved and bigger and better we will experience satisfaction. So she says, so cool it. What we need to do is transform our minds and not continually get into this mind of craving and acquisition and try to make things bigger and better and more exciting and more pleasurable. I mean, we are so out of control when it comes to our level of craving, and we can't satisfy ourselves. Verse 53, so Joe and Johanna, and I'm going to share something that came up yesterday about this one. Okay, so Joe and Johanna Blow say, okay, ordinary people are not so hot, but the really gorgeous ones, the really handsome ones are hot, so it's suitable to lust after them. Okay, so the ordinary Joe Schmoes and Johanna Schmoes, you know. And the verse is, among all those we are attracted to, there is not the least difference in sexual intercourse. When others too enjoy their appearance, what is your perfect person to you? So I want to share something that happened in the workshop yesterday. It was an epiphany of sorts, but it kind of goes with this. Because let me read Arya Deva's little thing here about this verse, and then I'll share the story of what happened. Okay, what use is this perfect person with a wonderful appearance, a gorgeous body, wonderful behavior to you who lust after them? Feeling attracted is inappropriate because unclean parts of all people stink. The body is filthy, and except for erroneous conception, there's not one bit of difference between good and bad regarding the sensations during sexual intercourse with this cesspit-like dark filth. So just in case you have any doubt about what's inside you or another person's body, he makes it very clear. So Now, this goes against, I think, some serious conditioning that we have that says that our bodies are beautiful and that sex is the be-all and end-all. This teaching totally contradicts, I think, probably lifetimes, countless lifetimes of whatever realm we were in, either, probably the God realm for sure, and the human realm. And that this view from our society that we can get conditioned by, that it produces so much desire and craving. So I want to share what happened. And I see this as a positive thing, and Arya Deva was there. So I was in the workshop yesterday morning, and I was starting a fire in our little stove for this little cat that we have in the barn. His name is Sona, and I've been starting the fire every morning to keep him warm and try to get him to trust us. So I'm standing in front of the stove, and I'm tearing apart the newspaper. It's some of our friends give us all these new newspapers from Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, so we use it to start fires. So I'm in the, I think it's the entertainment section of the Spokesman Review, and I'm opening up the pages. And I open this page, I'm just about to crumple it up, and in the middle of this page is a picture about this big, it's color, in the middle of this is the page, and there are 7 to 9 young men. I think they were a male dance review, performing at one of the local casinos. I won't tell you what they were called. They were not from this country. They were all standing there, legs astride, right shoulder to shoulder with their hands either on their hips or down at their sides, shirtless, huge, I mean, just buffed up, pecs, biceps, triceps, greased up, tan, faces kind of chiseled, a little bit of maybe 5 o'clock shadow, hair kind of, that kind of, you know, stuck up, and looking at the camera like, I mean business. And they're all standing, they're lined up, same pair of pants, just attached to their bodies like glue, with these huge belts and these big buckles right at their belly buttons. And there's the whole line is, and they're out in the chaparral out in the mountains somewhere. And they're performing at a casino somewhere. And I opened up the page, and I looked at them, and, you know, 25 years ago, and there was this moment there when I went, hello. Hello. And then Arya Deva arises in my mind and says, gentlemen, don't ever forget, you're just a poop and pee factory. And that you better tell those ladies who are going to pay a lot of money to see you dance and see you gyrate that you have poop and pee and vomit and mucus and spit and dandruff and earwax to go. So that they don't go away being disappointed. And that these, I mean, they may have been between 25 and 35, but it just struck me that here's this, in our culture, in our world, that this is entertainment, that the level of desire and craving that can be aroused in the mind of whoever's watching them, man, or could be men too, determines how much money they get. And that the whole evening is just getting people's minds to spin into sexual craving, sexual fantasies, sexual desire. I mean, these guys are probably students, they're professionals, they're probably married with kids, who knows? But the dream, the facade of these bodies being inherently from their side, gorgeous, sexual, inviting, provocative, don't you want to take one of them home with you kind of look? And I just was able to go past the, oh, hello. And Arya Deva was sitting right on my shoulder. And he said, Sam K, throw that paper in the fire, which is what I did. But then what happened, what arose in my mind as I was watching the fire burn, is the cause of samsara. That this distortion, that the body, though impure and foul, containing all this expulsion of disgusting material, that we have got it so distorted and so twisted that we really think that it is a source of deep sexual pleasure and satisfaction, and that we have an entire industry that caters to this kind of thinking, and that craving actually makes people money,
and Ashley is a sign of success. Anyway, it was really quite one of those epiphanies in the workshop that every once in a while I have them down there. Okay, so Ari Davis says, yes, MK, that's exactly right. This is nothing but a cesspit-like dark filth, in case you had any, no matter how the facade looks. So Joe and Johanna say, well, that cesspit only applies to ordinary people, because if you have this gorgeous hunk, it doesn't apply. And Ari Davis says, it doesn't matter who you have sex with, it's all the same. So then Venerable shared that one story that's in Gyalsub Jay's commentary about the husband who had an ugly wife. And he used to say to her, you are so ugly. So one day she puts out his dinner. Half the dinner goes into a beautiful china urn, and the other half goes into a clay pot. And so he goes, what's going on here? What's the difference? And she looks at him and says, it doesn't matter if you have sex with a beautiful woman or with me. It's all the same. I love that ugly woman. And that regarding the last two lines, when others too enjoy their appearance, whether they're, you know, male dancers, what is your perfect person to you? This is where Arya Davis shares that in ancient India, the women didn't go out very much. They had very, very cloistered, protected lives, and that many times, or most of the time, their marriages were arranged. And so the man and woman didn't see each other till the wedding day, and you actually went through the entire ceremony. She usually wore a veil, and that the husband didn't get a chance to look at his new wife until after the ceremony. And at that moment, everyone catches sight of her and might enjoy her beauty. So why are you clinging to her as your only perfect one when everybody else, at the same time that you get to look at her, everybody else does, and they find her attractive as well. So if you're going for this really spectacular, special, one-of-a-kind kind of person, she doesn't exist because everybody else is enjoying her at the same time. Now, even though we don't wear veils these days for the most part, the Venerable says, we sometimes think of our partners as personal property or just for our own pleasure, which is totally out of place. Okay, so that's verse number 53. Verse number 54, this one gets really, this is also a very direct, provocative one. Whoever sees a person as appealing thinks themselves satisfied with them, since even dogs and the like share this. Why, fool, are you so attracted? So why are you attracted to only good-looking partners? If good-looking partners were the real cause for your desire, then desire would never arise towards attractive people. But desire does arise towards unattractive people. It's confusion alone that causes desire. When he says desire can arise towards other people, Gyaltsev Jay says, you know, Grandma and Grandpa? Grandpa thinks Grandma's really hot. She's about 80 years old. She's lost most of her teeth. She's kind of bent over. Doesn't have much hair, but he thinks she's gorgeous. And then he proceeds to say, what about dogs? Dogs look at their mates. They get desire. They get craving for that mate. He says, pigs find their mates gorgeous. Sheep lust after their sheeps. They're all attracted to whoever is on the other side of the fence. So what Arya Davis does, he just takes this whole special relationship that we think we have with each other and just brings it right down to this basic fundamental thing that says the mind that sees other people as physically attractive is exactly the same mind as the pig's mind that looks at another pig and says, wow, I like that one. I want to have sex with her. The same mind. There is no difference. And Venerable says we need to just get our stubborn minds around this, because we continually justify that what we as human beings do is above what pigs do, what sheep do, what dogs do. When in fact the same craving mind is aroused in a pig, is aroused in a kitty, is aroused in a leopard, whatever. So what exactly are we attracted to? Because all those bodies are made of the four elements: earth, water, air and fire. Pigs' bodies are made of those same elements. Horses' bodies are made of those same elements. So what exactly are we attracted to? Kind of makes you think about, I'll never look at a pig or a sheep the same again. Okay.
Verse 55. This person, every part of whom is lovely or handsome to you, was common to all before. Finding them is not as astonishing as it is for you. And Joshua, there's one line that Geshe Topke on this verse that Joshua translated. He said, "No one was surprised by this person's appearance until you showed up." And suddenly, that person became like, oh my gosh. I'm fine. Until you started saying, oh my gosh, I'm in love. Joe and Johanna Blow, a captivating partner is hard to find, and since finding one is most remarkable, it's reasonable to desire them. Arya Davis says, the person was common to everyone before you met them. I mean, this is an interesting concept, that people go through their lives, they've got friends, they've got colleagues, they've got brothers and sisters, people who don't like them, people who don't care about them whatsoever, and you show up in their life, and even though they're commonly known by hundreds of people, once you show up and as soon as you impute that they're attractive or they're gorgeous or you want them, it's like you think that suddenly they're special, when in fact they're not. They're just a common, ordinary person, just like we are. So Arya Davis says, the person was common to everyone before you met them. So how can you find what is common astonishing? It's the label, silly, and the mind of attachment. So by us imputing special, precious, drop-dead gorgeous, I want them, I don't want to be without them, it imputes this entire label that takes them out of just being an ordinary human being into the realm of fantasy. So, and how much do, I mean, that we do that, I do that all the time. Okay, verse 56, Joe and Johanna, here we go again. Okay, so they're going to try to take another tact. Okay, since the body is in the nature of unsatisfactoriness, let's look at those good qualities. So if desire for attractive people in general is inappropriate, then it's reasonable to be attracted to someone with good qualities. Someone who's intelligent, honest, who's everything we've ever wanted, someone who's going to support our Dharma practice, someone who's going to support us emotionally, just fantastic, they're rich, they agree with our ideas, they bring us stuff. It's appropriate to be attracted to them. Why not? If those with good qualities seem attractive and they're opposite the reverse, which is true, the former or the latter, for neither alone persists. Okay, so now Arya Deva is going to refute this. Okay, if it's not the body that we're, quote, attracted to, let's go for the intellect. Let's go for all of those good qualities. So this is a really stunning refutation. If those with good qualities seem attractive, and we've already heard what the qualities are, and someone with bad qualities, those are the ones who are troublesome, complaining, disagree with us, point out our faults, are unattractive, then which one is true? Because the attractive one doesn't always display their good qualities. In fact, they have quite a few, quote, bad qualities. And that the unattractive ones don't always show their bad qualities, and they actually have a few good qualities of their own. So in the same person, you have both sets of qualities, sometimes right after another. And we know that. Sometimes we're in a good mood and something happens and we're totally, really pissed off. I mean, we go up and down. Some of our good qualities shine and some of our bad ones. So when one who has good qualities later has faults, which one is true? Are they the person with the good qualities or are they the person with the bad qualities? Therefore, desire for a person with good qualities and aversion towards a person that has bad qualities is inappropriate. No one has all good or all bad. So then Venerable follows this with her kind of putting her spin on it. There's something to think about, because when we fall in love, our shared experience is that all we see are people's good qualities. In fact, we exaggerate them. Sometimes we even make ones up that they don't even have. And then when we get to know them and we start living with them and we start having a close relationship with them and see other things, we think, we could swear that they have changed. Why aren't you the person that I fell in love with? You were charming and sweet and kind and considerate, brought me stuff. Now you leave dirty dishes in the sink, you don't flush the toilet, you sit on the couch all day, you complain about your ailments all the time. Who are you? When in fact the person who's living in our lives right then and there has always been there. It's just, Venerable says, But we painted a very fanciful picture in that they had no faults whatsoever. Now there's a little bit of shared responsibility here, because even though that person had all those not so good qualities in the beginning, when we're falling in love with somebody, we do our best to really hold back on those and put the bad qualities on the shelf for a while and really do bring out our good qualities. So we're in this sort of mutual deception in the beginning when we first fall in love with each other. So we're painting for each other this fanciful picture of someone who simply doesn't exist. We fall in love, she said, with a figment of our imagination, because no one like we imagined ever existed in the first place. And so she says, now, so we go over our past experiences in our life. And when we look in the past, she says, we are willing to, especially if we were married or in long-term relationships or dating, and then we eventually broke up or got divorced or things like that. She says, yeah, we can admit those ones in the past that we say, yeah, I exaggerated their good qualities. And that when I saw the bad ones, I broke up with them. You know, I just said, forget it. But this new person who's in my life right now, I have gotten so much wiser from all of those past experiences. This person really is intelligent. They know the Dharma wonderfully. Everyone admires them. They're very deep thinkers. Everything I've always wanted in a partner, I've learned my lesson. This is the real McCoy. This is the perfect person. I'm not exaggerating this time. And so this is, I mean, Venerable keeps going back around and saying, you know, the good qualities, the bad qualities, but we never learn our lesson to be able to look at each other as these impermanent, changing phenomena, changing moment by moment with all of the good stuff, all the bad stuff. We sort of create these figments of our imagination, and that's what feeds the desire, that's what feeds the sexual attraction. And then, of course, we're disappointed, because then the things that we think bring lasting happiness don't. So that's the one about do they have good qualities or do they have the bad one, which one is which. Okay, then verse 57. Let's see. Yeah, there's some, these are really, really, there's so much to say. Okay, this one's kind of interesting, because I think this has happened to a lot of us. A fool's desire does not arise only for those with good qualities. How can reason prevent those involved with it without reason? So the first two lines, a fool's desire does not arise only for those with good qualities. A fool will have desire for anybody and everybody, whether they have good qualities or not. It doesn't follow that only someone with good qualities that conforms to our ideas of what we want is a cause for desire, because we see that fools desire people who don't have very attractive qualities. So Venerable goes into this, because Ira Davis says, all those who are full of lust are shameless and not consistent, and reason doesn't influence them. And Venerable goes, well, look around at the people in our lives, you know, our siblings, our friends. And that we think, you know, we look around the people that we think have tons of faults. You know, gosh, I can't believe that person. And then we've got friends and family that just think they're the cat's pajamas. It's like, they're just remarkable. They're great. I just think they're just so cool. And we're like, what? And that a lot of our friends and relatives are married or partnered up with people who have a lot of faults. They steal, they do drugs, they have big mouths, they insult people, they sit around all day and do nothing. And this person that we really love just cares about them so much. We think that they're fools, because the only thing that we see is their bad qualities, or the only thing that they see is their good qualities. So both sides have got these minds of exaggeration where we're not being able to see the whole person. And so Venerable says that Arya David uses lots of reasonings, but for a fool who has lust for whoever appears to them as beautiful, even someone who has a lot of faults, you can't even talk to them or reason with them because they don't understand. Venerable goes into more detail here. She said, we have friends or families that are really in dysfunctional, unhealthy relationships. It's like they're glued to the hip with this person, that even though they're not really good for them, really that we've seen them have a lot of pain and go through a lot of struggles and suffer a lot with this person, the attachment is so strong that despite the suffering that happens in that relationship, there's no amount of reasoning, there's no amount of support, there's no amount of, can I just, you know, I'm concerned,
is that they go, yeah, I know that they're not the greatest, but they never do anything about it. The attachment is so strong that it overrides whatever pain, whatever suffering happens in that relationship. You see them falling into very difficult situations, but they won't hear it. So this verifies that, as Aryadeva says, is that fools are beyond reason. That when the attachment and the desire is driving the relationship and is in our minds, there's the nonsense, the craziness that we will put up with, and we just don't see it. Okay, let's cruise along here. I'm going to try to do the ones that I like. Let's see. Oh, here's the one. This one's kind of interesting. And kind of sad, too. This is number 58. As long as a person knows no other, they will remain with you. As with disease, they should always be kept from opportunity. This was the one that, you know, if you really love somebody and you don't want them to leave you, you've got to, like, prevent them from being attracted to other people or rejecting you. So Joe Blow and Johanna say, well, in ancient times, women used to commit suicide when their husbands died. And even a venerable said, even somewhat into modern times, that still continued to exist. Therefore, it is reasonable to form a relationship, and this is where they said it about a woman in particular, with a woman who desires you. Then if something happens to you, they'll kill themselves, and so no one will get them. They'll remain totally faithful to the end. Now, Venerable says, okay, so we're not that extreme today. But there are people who really do believe that they're soulmates. I mean, they are like attached at the hip. They're going to be together until they die. And I remember a few years ago, Venerable Verbena was doing a teaching on attachment in Seattle at DFF. And she was sharing that there was a couple back then, a Hollywood couple, who were so infatuated with each other that they wore these little vials of each other's blood around their necks. And that they were going to be together forever and ever, and this was a symbol of their love for each other. Of course, they have since divorced or married to other people. But they were so infatuated and inseparable from each other. So the misguided thinking here that if you can prevent someone you desire from either having somebody desire them or they desiring somebody else, and, you know, so that they'll leave you, if you can do anything to prevent that, do it. Which basically Venerable said, well, good luck, you might as well lock them in a closet, which unfortunately we have heard in the past year that people have done that. That people that have had their minds so deluded by attachment that they've actually kidnapped people and held them in closets and basements for years. And so that's where this attachment, this desire, this craving, this misconception has been taken to an incredible, deluded extreme. So we won't do that. And Aryadeva said, forget it. You know, you would have to basically lock them in a closet. You cannot prevent people from desiring other people. Okay. Then we'll jump to number... There's so much in here. Okay. Let's go to number 64. Blinded by desire, they do not see sensuality's faults like a leper scratching. Those free from desire see the infatuated as suffering like the leper. To a leper, scratching brings some pleasure, but it makes the leprosy worse because it causes bleeding and causes the wounds to ooze. Similarly, those whose wisdom mind is blinded by desire don't see the faults of sensuality. They don't see that indulging in it actually makes their situation in samsara worse because of the negative karma they are creating. And then it says, those free from desire see the infatuated suffering like a leper. These are the Aryas. These are the ones who have freed themselves from the itch of cyclic existence, the itch of desire. And so they have this incredible, when they see all of us suffering with this desire and this craving in our minds, they have this incredible compassion for those of us because they see the suffering due to this attachment to our bodies, to the attachment to other people's bodies. And that if we look around, people get themselves into the most amazing jams because of their attachment to sex. I mean, attachment to objects in general is a major problem that causes a lot of suffering. but especially sex, just the dysfunctional relationships, all the emotional, the physical harm. And this is, once again, I think Venerable was thinking about a lot of folks who are in very, very abusive relationships, that they really try to please the object of their desire. You know, and there's just enough forgiveness, there's enough apologizing, so that when people are abused and beaten by their partners, and then there's this time where there's some contrition that sets in and everything's fine and rosy, and then the beating starts again, that the attachment, and that they're so in their minds, they just want to make that person happy. If they can just do the right thing, if they can just keep low, and if they can just behave, is that there's this attachment that keeps them like a leper scratching, that just continually getting wounded in this relationship, but just don't know what to do because the attachment is so intense. We are so hooked. And she said, we all have had to struggle with this hook of attachment in our relationships. And she said, do we know of anybody in all of our life, and all the people we know come and go, have any of them had any ease with any of their relationships? There's a lot of struggle, there's a lot of attachment, there's a lot of suffering. And that we don't know anybody who has an easy relationship, and that we're continually disappointed as we try to deal with the attachment, because the attachment brings up these expectations. The desire just puts that whole relationship into a particular fantasy, that when reality bites, there's this huge amount of suffering, there's this huge amount of anger and disappointment and resentment that comes. And so we are like lepers scratching, and that the Aryas have incredible compassion and feel very, very sad when they see us just so hooked in, because it creates the causes for us to continually travel in cyclic existence over and over and over again, the attachment to these bodies. Then Joe and Johanna on verse 63 say, but pleasure comes from intercourse. And the verse says, even in intercourse with another person, pleasure arises from other factors. What sensible person would say it is caused by just their lover? So Aryadeva, if intercourse alone were the cause of pleasure, then both those with and without desire would experience pleasure, but they don't. Ask anyone that's been forced to, who's in an abusive relationship that has sex against their will. So the pleasure of intercourse is caused by other factors besides just desire. There's contact. There's a big factor called inappropriate attention. The mind that misapprehends the person and has built them up as a wildly wonderful thing and as a source of pleasure are major factors as well. So Aryadeva is basically saying that intercourse alone is not the source of pleasure, because if it were, you know, if you had it once, you should be satisfied, and that those with and without desire, when they have sexual intercourse, they should be able to experience desire like simultaneously. And there are people who have sexual intercourse against their will that don't have that experience. And that not only is sexual intercourse the cause of desire, but there's all this focused, inappropriate attention, exaggerating the qualities of that person that we're having a sexual relationship with. There's the contact of the bodies together. There's all that energy between the people. There's the causes, the conditions, the exaggeration of each other's parts, each other, you know, how we're seeing each other. And so this one basically says that it's not that simple, that there's a lot of causes and conditions that bring sexual intercourse to happen, that it's not just this, what we call desire, that there's a lot of other things that are involved. And Aryadeva just doesn't let up. And every time Joe and Johanna have something to say, but, he just says, no, no, no. And then we start getting into these ones about, now we're getting into some that are even more graphic. Let's do a few of those. Okay, here's one. This one Venerable kind of had fun with. So verse 69, if Joe and Johanna Blow are thinking more and more nonsensically here, but the bodies of people we're attracted to must be clean because people regard them as clean. So people think they're clean, they must be. They're really grabbing at straws at this point. They're just grasping. So this is a very interesting perspective on the foulness of the body. Clean things are looked upon as the most worthless of all. What intelligent person would say that it is clean?
It's absurd for any intelligent person to think that the body is clean by its nature. So he's saying even things like perfume, flowers, jewelry, clothing, all these things become worthless because they come in contact with the body. So the first two lines, clean things are looked upon as the most worthless of all. And this was so interesting to look at, is that after objects come in contact with the body, they become unclean and worthless. Someone wears an article of clothing. Do you feel comfortable putting it on your body after they've worn it? She used this example. Take one of the guys. It was when the Chenrezig was being built. She said, okay, let's take one of the guys out there. He wears his T-shirt all day, and he comes here, and he takes off and gives it to you. Would you put that on? Anything that we put on the body to disguise it, to disguise its uncleanliness, the body itself makes that item clean. Would you? And this is true. Would you use a towel that someone just dried themselves off with, even if they just went in to clean themselves in the shower? How about a toothbrush? How about a comb and a brush? How about socks? Even if they slept in the same sheets after taking a shower, we don't sleep in other people's sheets. Even if they're here for only one day, they go into the laundry because their bodies touch them. So just something contacting the body makes it dirty. So I was like, this is so amazing. I never even thought of it that way. So once again, this is Aryadeva trying to refute this whole like this nonsensical thing. Well, because people say their bodies are clean, they must be, therefore they must be okay to have sex with, is that anything that touches our bodies, we immediately see as something that has to be, that's unclean. So keep that one in mind. Okay. Okay, let's see. Oh, here's the one. Okay. This is verse number 70. Joe and Johanna. The body is clean because we see people take pride in it. Whoever has lived in a privy, a bathroom, a toilet, and without it would not have survived, in such a dung worm, arrogance arises only through stupidity. So what they're talking about here is that whatever has been born in a womb has lived in, I mean, a womb is located between the stomach and the intestines. So living in a womb is basically like living in a toilet. You're right in the middle of the digestive system of your mom, and all the masticated food has got to get to us first before it gets sent to the bowels. I mean, we're kind of right in the stream. We're right in the middle of the route. So although we imagine birth to be this really beautiful experience, the baby comes out and everyone's happy, but I don't know. I haven't been to a birth, but I've seen pictures. First of all, you come out covered with excrement. I mean, you know, you've just been so traumatized by coming through the birth canal. You're in this embryonic sac, you know, because you've been breathing through this placenta the whole time. So this baby comes out, it just is covered with stuff. I don't know what they smell like, but probably not very good. But we're not very pretty when we arrive. We have all the stuff on our throats. They've got to take that little thing and just kind of suck all the stuff out of our noses and out of our throats. So like a dung worm that has been nurtured by excrement, and once again, dung worms, this is, you know, referring to ancient India, where they're, if you go to India even now these days, there's just these dung patties all over the place. They dry them out and use them for fuel. That these little dung worms subsist and live in the excrement, without which they would not have survived. That's like our body. So although having pride, thinking it's clean, arises through stupidity, is that even the birth process of this body itself was really foul and really disgusting. So Aryadeva once again keeps reminding us that it is not as it appears. You know, the outside, you can scrub it and clean it as much as you want. The inside is disgusting. From the time we're born to the time we die, we're basically embodied in these foul, unclean. There isn't one orifice that doesn't expel something gross, and we've so much kind of covered this over with our minds because we don't want to admit it. Okay, so I'm going to go right to, we're going to miss flowers and perfume and more of the same. We're going to go to the number 75, which was the summary. In summary, all four, that is impermanence, uncleanness, suffering, and selflessness are possible with regard to a single thing. So Joe and Johanna finally ask a good question. Is it possible for a single thing to comprise all four of these undistorted features, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, boundlessness, and selflessness? Yes, in fact, it is possible for one thing to comprise all of them. These four pertain to any kind of polluted thing produced under the influence of ignorance and karma. So he ties them all together. And he uses these syllogisms, and they're really quite, they really tie all those four distortions together. And I'm just going to read this because it will make it go a lot faster than me talking about it. Whatever is a product is impermanent because it is momentary. Okay, you got that one. Impermanence is unclean because it produces aversion. Does the reason apply to the subject? Whatever is impermanent produces aversion. Is this true? And this is how he explained it. Whatever is impermanent is going to decay. So yes, it will produce aversion. Our bodies, flowers, food, anything that decays, I mean, that's the process of all of those things. So after a while, they decay, they rot. Therefore, impermanence produces aversion. When something decays, we feel aversion towards it. If beautiful things were permanent, then we'd never feel aversion for dead flowers or dead bodies. So the process of the impermanence itself brings aversion. The intelligent become free of desire because they see the nature of the product, referring to things being produced by ignorance, affliction, and karma, not like the Buddha's wisdom, which although is impermanent, is not produced under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. Since samsaric things are unstable and unreliable, everything is unstable and unreliable in samsara. Thinking that anything will give us lasting happiness, peace, and security is our hallucination. And then he continues. Whatever is unclean is going to be unsatisfactory because it harms. And whatever is unsatisfactory lacks some kind of concrete self. Impermanence is unclean, uncleanliness is unsatisfactory, and unsatisfactory is selfless. By contemplating the nature of the uncleanliness exemplified by our body, we try and develop an aversion to cyclic existence, which is a situation governed by ignorance, affliction, and karma, and where we encounter everything in cyclic existence in a constant state of flux that leaves us disappointed because it never lasts. So the whole point of this, the last paragraph, Venerable wanted to really, she really spent some time with this. She said, Arya Devitt is not trying to depress us. And this whole chapter on the body was really very provocative. I just felt like I'd been put into rehab for like 2 weeks. I mean, my mind was just totally like, and I kept resisting. And I kept saying, God, I'm getting in a really, really bad mood here. But Arya Devitt isn't trying to depress us. He's trying to get us to see that maybe this world of sense pleasure is not the be-all and end-all. Maybe our life has another purpose rather than chasing sense objects. And maybe there is a happiness that is greater than the happiness we get from these sense objects. A happiness that comes from developing our own hearts, love, compassion, and wisdom. And to realize that all other living beings struggle with these four distortions just like us. And so we aspire to free ourselves from the misery caused by these and then help others to free themselves as well. So we develop and actualize compassion, purify and transform our minds, and become awakened so we can actually do that. So, you know, this, in the beginning, this was probably my least favorite chapter that we heard because of all the resistance I had to wanting to admit to the fact that this body of mine is a little cesspit of dark filth. But I'll tell you, it was very sobering and it was also very clarifying. And to see that this body, and what Venerable was very clear about is that this body is precious in that it is the basis for
practicing the Dharma. If we can, and so we keep it healthy, we keep it clean, we give it exercise, because without this body in this human life, we really can't practice the Dharma. So that is the context in which we need to hold this body of ours, is that that's part of the basis for our awakening in this life. And to let go of all this extraneous garbage that just fills our minds, and that it takes a really long time to let go of this idea about the body being pure and clean. I mean, for those of us who have dedicated our lives to monastic life, you know, kind of given up more of the extraneous, you know, things out there that bring, that cause this to arise, we're not out of the woods. You know, we're not safely ensconced in our little monastic life. That mind of craving and sexual desire is still there, maybe getting trained, getting transformed. But that little moment at that wood stove in the workshop showed me that I still must be careful, because I can easily go off. I am not yet an Arya. I have a long way to go to be an Arya, so there I must really pay attention and use the Dharma to be a very powerful antidote to this craving mind that desires other bodies and is attracted to my own, and just over the top with this body of mine. So anyway, so hopefully that was helpful tonight. Let's dedicate all the virtue of our looking at our bodies and other people's bodies in a new light, thanks to the fierce and compassionate commentary by Aryadeva.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.